Welcome to Beetle Blethers with Jerry Hassan and Alan McClure. Well, hello again there, Beetle fans. It's episode 3 of Beetle Blethers with me, Alan McClure, and Jerry Hassan. And this week we're delighted to be joined by author and music journalist Graham Thompson. There are some sound issues on this episode. I do apologise for that. Entirely my fault. The other two are blameless. But it's worth persevering because you get some wonderful insights from Graham and some good old blethers from me and Jerry. Graham's written books about some iconic figures, Kate Bush, Elvis Costello, John Martin, Simple Minds. And of course, this week we're focusing on his excellent biography of George Harrison called Behind That Locked Door. Have a wee listen, see if you agree with him and us about George's role in the band and in the wider world. And if you've got any of your own ideas about the magical mystery of George Harrison, then do please feel free to get in touch and let us know. I hope you enjoy it. All the best. Graham, could you tell us a wee bit, first of all, before we get into the nitty-gritty, just give us a wee bit background of your own interest in musicians, because you're not a Beatles specialist per se, but you are a music journalist and you've covered a lot of fascinating characters. And I wonder if you'd like to tell us a wee bit about how you choose who you're going to cover and what your personal kind of fascinations are where music is concerned.
It's kind of instinctive. I mean, obviously you're going on a lot of research and you're going on a lot of people have walked there before you. But I think it's ultimately you have to kind of feel that you've got a sense of the person and what makes them tick and their contradictions as well.
Absolutely.
When you feel that, it's when you can start to feel you can actually write the book because you have a sense of who they are.
Yeah.
It must be a fascinating journey to go on for you as well as for the reader, of course, which it's a superb book, by the way. We should mention this to our vast audience, but you did a great job. But you've stated that you're not a Beatles expert even yet. And I wonder if you're immersion in the life of George Harrison encouraged or discouraged you to kind of deep dive into the band and its very well storied career?
I mean, I was a Beatles fan. I mean, I know my Beatles stuff fairly well in terms of the kind of bread and butter of it, you know. I mean, and remember, you know, this book was written, it's coming out in a new remastered edition, but it was written nearly 15 years ago now, so I was fairly well immersed in it at that time. And certainly in my, you know, in my 20s, in the 1990s, you know, I knew my Beatles stuff pretty well. And, you know, around the time of the anthology, I was very into what was happening there. But I think even in the time that's passed since I wrote this book, it's become such a kind of... the Beatles industry and the academic work around it is so kind of boggling and so incredibly admirable in many ways.
We've talked about saying it's kind of never-ending, isn't it?
I feel very kind of... remiss to call myself an expert in any way. And it was one of the reasons I was slightly trepidatious about doing this book even then, was that, you know, I had images of a sort of articulated truck coming, backing up to my flat with all the weight of what had been written about the Beatles. There's so much there. There's so many ways you can get into the story. And so I felt I liberated myself from that by thinking, well, I'm with George. You know, what's George doing?
Yeah.
So, for instance, you know, when they're making Sgt. Pepper, which most Beatles book would spend a huge amount of time writing about, it kind of passes very quickly in my book. George wasn't all that involved, apart from that wonderful song Within You, Without You that he contributed. He's not on a lot of that album, and even on the big songs, he doesn't do very much on them. So I thought, well, I've got to stick to that. You know, I've got to stick to my premise that there's plenty of other places you can read about the making of Sgt. Pepper. It's not really where his head was at that point. So... I know my Beatles up to a point.
You know your stuff. There was a time when you could imagine you were a Beatles expert just by having heard the songs and maybe read a book, but as you say, the field of research and the field of endeavour in the field of Beatleology is almost ludicrous now, whereby every single person who had any kind of passing acquaintance with a band or involvement with them is somewhere in print now, which is fascinating if you like that kind of thing, but... Yeah, there's only so much detail that you necessarily need. The thing with Sgt. Pepper might bring us on to an interesting subject in a wee bit, namely George's status in those grand kind of iconic Beatles moments. But I wonder if we could maybe start with, since you wrote your book 15 years ago, and if you have a sense of what the kind of Gen Z or the new Beatle fans are feeling about the band. George's songs seem to be the ones which are most streamed on Spotify and other cursed platforms like that. And I think there's a kind of consensus amongst young folk that George is kind of secretly the cool one. You know, we all know that John and Paul are the big ones, yeah. But George is the underdog and the kind of, he's the one that's got a bit of cachet. Even if you don't think the Beatles themselves are very cool, he's the one that actually was quite cool in the band. I don't know if you've had a sense of that changing since your book came out, or have you observed that?
Definitely, I've definitely felt that. I felt it among some of my children's generation and some of their friends, you know, who are very kind of keen on George. Mm. And I don't know if there's one easy answer to it. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, he's quite enigmatic. You know, obviously, I think, you know, interestingly, John Lennon seems to have kind of fallen out of favour in some ways with the younger people. Mm. Paul is Paul. You know, Paul is, I suppose, the torchbearer for the Beatles now. Mm. Ringo is his own thing as well. You know,
peace and love.
Listening to George Harrison's music and you know, reading this book, as I have again recently, because I had to kind of go through it for this new edition, I'm struck by how, you know, how personal his writing was, how he never seemed capable of telling a lie in a song.
Mm, yes,
we agree.
He once said to Paul, you know, you just make this stuff up, you know, it's Maxwell Silverhammer and it's Rocky Raccoon and it's these stories. And he was incapable of doing that, which is a limitation in some ways as a writer. And you can hear those limitations, I think.
Without doubt. Yeah.
But it's also quite compelling when somebody feels the need to tell you something about themselves. And there's a lot of that in his songs, like I Want to Tell You, or, you know, literally that song. We never quite know what he's trying to tell us in that song, but he wants to tell us something. And it's always this sense of it's coming from a very true and honest place. And I wonder whether that resonates. And also, the you know, the melodies in those songs, like Something and Here Comes the Sun and While My Guitar Gently Weeps, are very, very rich, very pure. Yeah. Simplicity to his writing, I think, that resonates now. Mm. And his character, the idea of someone kind of searching for something beyond the sort of easy trappings of fame and fortune, is quite attractive to us at the moment.
Yeah, you've got a passage in the book, Graham, where you talk about the arc of George's songwriting over the Beatles and that reportage element of it from the early 1963 track, Don't Bother Me, through when he's talking about the early years with Patty and the euphoria of the early years of romance, through Taxman, and everybody knows the story of Only a Northern Song and his disenchantment with that. But there's something in that that's a really telling arc. And then through to the latter days of the swan song days of the Beatles, where he's even, I mean, All Things Must Pass begins, as we know, as a Beatles demo. He's thinking of the end of the Beatles before it's the end of the Beatles.
Yes, and Wah-Wah, all these things that are doing his head in with the band. And I think it's, you know, he could be very blunt in conversation and he could be very, very blunt in song. And you do hear him addressing the kind of the compelling issues in the band and in the dynamic of the band as they are happening. And there's something very kind of admirable about that, you know, he's not the quiet one, although he's not really addressing these problems face-to-face with his bandmates, but he's definitely doing it in a creative way and getting it off his chest. And I think...
Is there a sense...
very compelling. I
was just... from what you're saying there, I wonder whether we could think of George as almost like the conscience of the band, while the more grandstanding individuals are out in front and not necessarily talking about what, you know, it's a bit meta to be talking about the band that you're in the songs that your band are releasing, but it's almost like a conscience thing or a let's keep ourselves grounded. This is still a thing that's actually going on with actual people in the actual world. That seemed to have been a thing that George was keenly aware of.
Yeah, and let's not forget, you know, he could be quite sternly moralistic as well.
Mm, oh, yes.
You know, not always to the most attractive degree. There's a bit of finger wagging going on there as well. So, you know, that was part of his character, was to call out stuff as he saw it and to, the moral policeman, the conscience, the sort of truth teller. You know, Lennon, of course, I think is, you know, probably held up, or was anyway, as a great truth teller in the Beatles. But, you know, it's maybe more a more personal, visceral truth with John Lennon. He's wrestling with himself. I think we hear George wrestling with him being in the band, and you know, that's a huge fault line right through his life. Is you know, to love the Beatles or to hate the Beatles?
Yes, indeed. And I think I wondered recently whether obviously George had probably arguably the most stable, most kind of normal upbringing when he was very young. And was super supported. Paul was supported by his dad, but obviously Paul lost his mum, and then John's childhood was exceptionally complicated. But maybe George just couldn't really relate to some of the things that were motivating John and Paul, because he did have quite a stable background, albeit from a good working class family, but he wasn't someone who had really suffered early trauma or tragedy to the extent that John and Paul did, and that must have informed a lot of what they produced.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think he had those ambitions to kind of unburden himself against any great wrongdoing or any great sense of injustice or great emotional upheaval, because he didn't really experience that. You know, I think his position in the band as the youngest and perhaps the sort of the less regarded member of the band for a long time within the band, although he was loved, you know, his talents weren't necessarily appreciated. I think that, you know, that was maybe his bugbear rather than any great existential problems that he had in his life, because as you say, he had a very loving home life. He was the youngest son, doted on by his mother, loved by his father. And again, I think they were quite, you know, they were straight talking people. So I think he inherited that part of his personality just to say things as he saw it. But yes, no great existential trauma there.
Alan and I were talking earlier about, and you mentioned just there, Alan, about whether George was the conscience or spirit of the Beatles. And one of the things we were sort of thinking about was, you know, the current sort of canonisation of the Beatles and Paul's, you know, never-ending search to tell the story and, you know, tell us all what we know how important the Beatles were, kind of loses something about the absurdity that the Beatles embraced, the surreal nature of some of their humour and so on. And George, in some sense, do you think, you know, his bafflement at Beatlemania and his being disturbed by Beatlemania, and then in the 70s, you know, his distancing and then his embrace of the Ruttles, you know, to my mind, like, you know, the greatest story of the Beatles ever told. There's something in there how he actually keeps something about that spirit alive that is, I think, to my mind, a bit more interesting than McCartney's continual, you know, want to be validated.
Definitely. No, I would agree with that. He always recognised the absurdity of it, I think. And was never that sentimental about it, you know, but it's become a very sentimental fairy tale, the story of the Beatles, and I understand why, and there are elements of it that are very poignant and touching, but it's not a fairy tale, and you know, the dynamic between all of them was quite combustible at the best of times, and I think George was just very clear about that.
Yeah.
And I wonder if it's because, you know, I think I write this in the book, and, you know, I'm not overstating anyone's position, but saying, you know, I think we can relate to George in a way because with a following wind, I think we could maybe see how we might have ended up in the Beatles the way George did.
So yes.
Oh, yes, of course.
It's pretty easygoing. Picked up by a mate. Yeah. Just want, you know, it's happy really for a while just to play guitar in a band, and it could have been any number of bands in Liverpool. And I think we relate to him as a kind of everyman figure in that band, and then who someone who raised his game, you know, who actually did see he had much more to offer than the position he was being put into, and who raised his game and found he could offer a huge amount more than that. But I think he is someone that that's always kept that sense of the absurdity of being in that band, and also the. He'd never smoothed over how scary it was, I think,
that's
to be
right.
in the centre of Beatlemania.
Yeah, he was
in the mid-60s, you know, when literally getting torn limb from limb and can't leave a room. I think he was particularly ill-suited to that temperamentally. Frenzy of it all, but I think that kind of wounded him quite deeply.
I think you're right,
I think he would have been a happier adult had all of that not happened. And I think his aspirations for the band were different from John and Paul's in that he frequently stated and seems to have demonstrated that really all he wanted to do was play guitar in a band, and if they were getting gigs every week, then so much the better. But he certainly hadn't any aspirations to be a world international. I don't think he was that bothered about being bigger than Elvis. Obviously, John had to compete with everybody, but George was just perfectly content to do what he did. I wonder whether he was musically disadvantaged more than the others, or more keenly aware of the fact that his musical ambitions were not being met by the lifestyle, and that might have led to some of his early frustrations with the whole touring scene.
Yeah, I think so, because obviously, you know, the Beatles as a live band were after Hamburg, really, it was a very unsatisfying entity for them, because they felt they were playing just to a wall of noise and not really being able to, you know, to show their evolution as musicians and recording artists. None of that stuff was really ever shown on stage.
That's
right till the very end, they were playing, you know, Long Tall Sally and stuff like that. So it's a very odd sort of dichotomy. And I think one thing that's often overlooked in the Beatles story is what a big deal it was when they stopped playing live. They obviously created incredible music after that. But for George, for someone whose raison d'etre really in the band was to play guitar, and was a rock and roll guitar player, and who'd come up through all the clubs, I think that, you know, from that point on, I think he had half a foot out of the Beatles. Mm. You know, if you look at his interests after that, he was in India within a few weeks after that, learning about, you know, the sitar and about Eastern spirituality and philosophy, and sitting at the knee of Ravi Shankar. I think he, by that point, he felt, I need to get something else in my life, because this band is no longer what it was, and my role in it is no longer as fundamental as it used to be. And I think we actually overlook how big a deal that was in the Beatles story.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And he was oddly dominant at that point, wasn't he? Because the move to Indian music and the various spiritual awakenings that they had, and certainly when Maharishi appeared on the scene, George was very much the mover and shaker. And I think John in particular was sort of interested in George's insights and was interested in his revelations. There's the whole relationship with John and George, that bonding over acid, which Paul missed out on and Ringo missed out on to some extent, and that kind of spiritual brotherhood. So while he maybe withdrew himself from the band as a brand, he certainly didn't withdraw himself from the people or his friends in the band. He was still curious about the journey they were going on and eager to join with them. Complex fellow all round, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's actually leading, you know, if you look at Rishikesh and that whole experiment in the foothills of the Himalayas, you know, that is really, George is leading that charge. He's bringing the rest of the band with him, because that's really his deal. And as you say, John, you know, John's probably a more passive personality by that point. And he's, I think he's also interested in George's evolution. I think he's, I mean, we maybe all understand this when we see someone who we maybe regarded as someone who was younger or maybe less worldly than us suddenly kind of come into their own. I think John was fascinated by that with George, and saw this guy blossoming.
Possibly threatened. I was wondering, Graham, I mean, I know Paul to this day is not especially effusive about George's songwriting. You know, he'll say, well, he wasn't really interested, and then at the end he did something and Here Comes the Sun, and that's kind of seems to be the sum total of what Paul remembers about George's songwriting. But I wonder if that's because George didn't really pose any kind of threat to Paul's status as the multi-instrumentalist orchestrator, all that kind of stuff, whereas John, who was already maybe a kind of his youthful energy certainly was spent before the others was, he didn't really pay much attention, or he didn't contribute a great deal to George's songs in the studio. He's not on While My Guitar Gently Weeps, I don't think, and he's not on one or two of the others. So possibly while he was interested and pleased for George, I wonder if it wasn't very good for him and his very unreliable ego.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true. They didn't, you know, we can look in hindsight at those songs that George was writing towards the end, but I still don't think he was regarded as anything other than the junior partner. Very much so in the songwriting stakes, and it was tolerated. But as you say, there wasn't, there wasn't the amount of effort really put into his recordings. But also, he was a very different kind of musician. You know, he was very methodical. Yeah. He was very, in some ways, the antithesis of Lennon, who liked spontaneity and energy and could play it different every time. George liked to have his solos worked out and his parts sorted out. And I'm not sure when you have two absolutely instinctive musicians like McCartney and Lennon sitting next to you, that always, you know, that and that maybe didn't present George at his best. I think they got a bit bored sometimes of running through these songs. There's some songs like Not Guilty, which I think there were 69 takes of, which in Beatles world is an awful lot. That was his personality. You know, he liked to have things locked in. He liked to know what he was doing. He liked to have things right. And that was just his character. And I think, you know, so a lot of those songs that he wrote at the end of the 60s, which turned up on his solo records, he was able to make them materialize in the way that he wanted. And I think he was much happier outside of the Beatles as a musician. I think it played much more to his personality to be able to just do this and not with a bunch of friends, but not friends who in some ways threatened him or were slightly disregarding of his abilities.
He certainly was he's the facilitator. Post breakup, he's the one that facilitates the most interesting things, I think. The others maybe I suppose Ringo with his all-star band, bless him, is still out with his pals doing that thing. But
and the Ringo 1973 album, and that's it, you know.
Of course, yes.
Where they all come together on different tracks.
But George loved living with the band, didn't he? When he came back with some of his dissatisfaction in the Let It Be film is because he's just been in Woodstock with Robbie Robertson and Garth Hudson and all that lot. And they're instinctive, brilliant musicians, but maybe just gave him the room to join in as he fit, as and when he pleased.
Yeah, and as we're saying, you know, how George influenced the latter period of the Beatles, I think, you know, we can hear that in Let It Be, that let's get back to basics, let's jam in a room, albeit not a bucolic up in the Catskill Mountains, but a horrible film studio in Twickenham.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea was kind of there, so you do see him leading these ideas in. And then, I mean, I'm always kind of amused by what happens after the Beatles, because he becomes, if it's possible to become a bigger star than you are as a Beatle, he does. You know, he has this incredible couple of years where it's All Things Must Pass and it's My Sweet Lord and it's a concert for Bangladesh. And he finds himself, I think, quite unwillingly, you know, probably the number one Beatle. He's the guy most likely to all of a sudden because he's on a roll, I think.
But he didn't go for... Yes, you're absolutely right. I think he had a huge body of work there, and that was his golden period. Imagine being able to release all your best songs on your first two albums because you've had years at the feet of the best songwriting duo in the...
Maybe should have kept a few back.
Maybe you should have kept a few back.
Or like the White Album, it should have been one album, you know. And then you could have had another album.
Yeah.
But even with that, both of those huge big first projects, they are very collaborative, aren't they? He didn't want to be George Harrison superstar. The ensemble work on the All Things Must Pass, including the third disc, which maybe isn't that often listened to, but it does sound like a lot of folk having a great time together, and there's not one star in, you know, no one is the star or focus of those jam tracks. And then, of course, the concert for Bangladesh, not only was it him along with a lot of his friends, but the purpose of it was very specifically not him. The purpose of it was for other folk and for humanitarian reasons. And he did like to deflect the focus, even when he was on the biggest stage imaginable.
Always. And that's a recurring theme right through his solo career. You know, maddeningly so to a lot of the people who were trying to work with him. You know, Bill Graham famously, you know, there's the one tour that George Harrison does of America. Mm. In 1974, which is a bit of a disaster. And, you know, George just, I mean, I can't help but love it, really. He just refuses to play the Beatles card. He refuses to play the game. He refuses to do what is so blindingly obvious to do, which is just to play, you know, play into the hands of an American audience who haven't seen a Beatle perform live since 1966. And he just can't do it. You know, he has Ravi Shankar opening the show, there's musicians coming on and off all the time, Billy Preston's playing songs. I think he plays three Beatles songs and he changes the words to them.
In My Life Is Over.
With an instrumental. It's just this incredibly counterintuitive, cussed wrestling with his legacy. And I'm still not sure how much of that was pure kind of bloody-mindedness and how much of it was just exactly who he was and just did not want to do it any other way. It's one of the great sort of own goals, I think, of music history, that tour.
And what do you think, Graham, about the... to my mind, George did make some kind of peace with the Beatles, some kind of peace with the Beatles' past. And just talking again earlier, I mean, I personally never liked all those years ago. I've always thought it's a little bit of a, just, I don't know, to me, not very melodic, fairly obvious. But again, though, it is fairly obvious. When We Was Fab, I think, it's got just a sense of jolliness in it and celebration. And okay, buying into the myth that he doesn't quite buy into. But he did come to terms in some way, and it's not quite maybe anthology, but the Live in Japan album versus compared to 74, he does play lots and lots of his Beatle tracks. And is there some way in which he did come to terms with that? Or is he just giving people what they want and feels he has to?
I think he did, and then he didn't. I think he seemed to be in this constantly kind of contradictory state of, you know, at times recognising that the hand that the Beatles gave him, how incredibly positive that was and how useful that could be when he's returning as a solo artist or he's doing certain things. And then there's times when he talks about the Beatles as if it's the worst thing that ever happened to him. And it's just the most awful memory and something that he wants to get as far away from as possible. But you're right. I mean, I think after John Lennon died, there seems to be a sort of rapprochement with the whole idea of the Beatles, and he maybe softens a bit, because there's also that song, you know, When We Was Fab, that whole collaboration with Jeff Lynne on Cloud Nine and with the Traveling Wilburys, he very consciously plays with the sound and the sensibility of the Beatles in quite a playful and amiable way, and a lot of that resentment seems to have gone. You know, I know from talking to, you know, the guy who directed Anthology, Jeff Wanfor, who put it together, there's still a lot of tricky stuff going on during that. I think, you know, it came out fairly sanitized, that series. Mm-hmm. And some of it, I think, was just he liked sort of messing with people. I think he liked to just throw a spanner in the work sometimes, and just when people were getting too sentimental or too cozy about the Beatles, I think he liked that idea of just making it a little more uncomfortable for them. Because as you said, and as we said earlier, that's how he saw it. It wasn't an easy story. It wasn't a fairy tale. There was ups and downs. And I think he quite liked reminding people of that.
And that also fed into his non-Beatle work after his non-musical work, didn't it? I mean, I think probably both were true. I think probably it was both the most amazing thing that could happen to you at that time of your life and possibly one of the worst things that could happen to you at that time in your life. And he just never felt that he owed anybody an explanation about that. He did the job and now he was on to the next thing. But his fascinations post-Beatles, I mean, one could argue, we were talking earlier, that after the breakup of the band, the member who had the most diverse effect on the cultural landscape was George, because of his work with Handmade Films and really was a titan of the British film industry throughout the late 70s and 80s.
And again, you know, it came from... It's all very genuine with George. You know, it came from friendship. It came from just wanting to help people. It wasn't so much an artistic decision or an artistic sensibility behind that. It was more like, these are good people. You know, Eric Idle obviously did the Ruttles, which he loved. Mm. He loved that idea of taking the mickey out of the Beatles. And so, you know, it came out of financing The Life of Brian, which were his friends, Monty Python. And then it just kept going, because I think he was interested in other people's creativity. You know, he wasn't, as we said, he wasn't a kind of solo guy in any respect. And I think that's where he's very different from John Lennon and Paul McCartney, is that he really craved collaboration. And I think that was a lot of the hurt that he felt in the Beatles. It wasn't a genuine collaboration most of the time. He didn't feel that it was a give and take in the purest form. And I think he really looked for that once the Beatles broke up, and he found it in music and film and in all sorts of other endeavours that he went on to do.
To break out. I think we've all experienced that, haven't we? The thing where you... Patterns that are set in stone at particularly influential times in your life are difficult to break. Like when you go home to see your parents and you're in your 40s or 50s, you sometimes do just slip back into the mode. And you'd love to think you could have a lovely adult, wise conversation heart to heart, but there's so much baggage in some relationships that it's difficult to break that. But having said that, I think I read some comments on... I shouldn't read YouTube comments, nobody should, but I read some comments from underneath a George interview on YouTube, and folk were saying, oh, he's so ungrateful. He'd been critical of Paul, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And they were saying, oh, Paul, if he hadn't asked you to be in the band, you wouldn't have been in the band. Missing the point that if he hadn't been in the band, it wouldn't have been that band, because the chemistry and the relationships was such a huge bit. It's what makes them, for me anyway...
Yeah,
so magical and so much better than the Stones, if I may toss out a grenade there.
Yeah, exactly.
But their personal relationships were absolutely integral to everything they did, including the magnificent work of John and Paul, which would have been different. It might have still been great, but it would have been different if they didn't have George as a sideman or as a friend.
Yeah. It's the whole four. It's the chain, isn't it? Ringo adds the final bit as well. Ringo for years has been diminished, but Ringo adds something. Ringo's brilliant, like stoicisms and, you know, take on the world adds something. It's the four. It's the fact. It's the four.
Totally, and that, you know, personality wise and musically, and sometimes we forget what George brought to those classic Beatles songs. You know, the riffs on Please Please Me, those sixth chords that he brought to She Loves You, that beautiful acoustic riff in And I Love Her, which is his, which really is a hook of the song. You know, the song hasn't got an awful lot going on. You know, if you hum And I Love Her, you're probably singing George Harrison's guitar part. He brought it in his harmonies. You know, he's an incredible team player who brought an awful lot of musical pizzazz to the songs that he didn't write, and brought a huge amount of of great stuff to the Beatles in the songs he did write. So yes, he wasn't just a passenger in the Beatles. He was integral to what that band was.
Graham, just as we've got about a few minutes left to just to kind of wrap things up, just in the kind of a couple of concluding, you know, thoughts from us and yourself. One is, when you're saying that, have you got a favourite George track or a favourite George musical moment that to you you think maybe people could think a bit more about? Or
yeah, I mean, there's several. There's a song called Run of the Mill, which is on All Things Must Be.
Oh, yes.
I think
it's
a really beautiful kind of summation of his philosophy and his sort of gentleness in a way, and his way with a melody. And actually, I love, there was an album called Early Takes that came out around the time of the Martin Scorsese film, where it's just George, mainly with an acoustic guitar. It's very, very stripped down, and there's a quality to his voice and his playing in that environment that I think actually shows a different side to him as a musician. And I love those versions of very well-known songs and some Bob Dylan songs and Everly Brothers and stuff he loved. I would encourage people to listen to those, because I think you get a sense of how soulful a person and how soulful a musician he could be. And I think sometimes actually he second-guessed himself a little bit and polished things up a little bit more than he needed to be. That was maybe part of his nature, but there's a real rustic quality to those songs that's beautiful. Mm-hmm.
And some of those were popping up for years in his solo albums, like Beautiful Girl and things like that he did dust off. And I agree completely with you, Graham. That's exactly my feeling, is that he did overdo some of the stuff that, possibly not his fault, that's just the nature of the beast, but those unguarded demos where some of them are even still works in progress, which he would have never done, you know, he wouldn't have dreamed of exposing that live to an audience. But hearing the work in progress and hearing him as just a guy on a musical journey, and he sounds so delightful and so kind of almost naive, but you know, as you've said earlier, always totally honest. You never feel like he's taking you for a ride. He's really trying to tell you what's on his mind right now in every single one of them.
That's so true. And actually, just what it popped into my head, there's a beautiful duet he does with Paul Simon. I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
And that, he's such an effortless accompanist, you know. And it's the same with Bob Dylan at Bangladesh. He is a fantastic, he must have been a fantastic person to play with, you know, because he just slots in there. He's playing Here Comes the Sun and I think Homeward Bound with Paul Simon. It's stunningly, stunningly good. You just see how, what a intuitive and selfless musician he was.
So could we maybe, as a final question possibly, and I'm sorry that our time is limited today, but we'd love to chat to you again, Graham, if we can. But as a final question, after you'd finished the book, and certainly after you've finished the most recent revision, do you like George Harrison? I mean, do you feel, as a person, do you feel that you would have liked to have known him? Is he somebody that was, you feel would have been approachable? Or was he generally just unknowable? How do you feel as a man who's finished an excellent biography of him?
I would love to have met him. I do like him. I mean, he's a very flawed guy, as we all are. You know, I've read criticisms, a few criticisms of my book, saying that, oh, it's a bit negative about him, or it's and I actually don't feel it's a negative portrayal at all. I hope it's kind of rounded, and I think he was a really complicated and three-dimensional human being. And he, you know, we haven't really talked about his kind of religious life and his ascetic life, and then his more, you know, celebrity lifestyle.
Oh yes, yeah.
He was very emblematic of the kind of contradictions and difficulties people go through in trying to lead a meaningful life. He stuck at it. He believed in it. He was committed. He was honest about his failings as much as anything else. So I liked him very much. I think he could be a difficult person, but then who can't be?
Yes. Yeah. That's great.
Okay.
Well, it's been an absolute delight to talk to you again, Graham, and thanks for calling in and joining us.
Thank you. Lots to ponder and think about the world of George.
Yes, indeed.
And just to say, George Harrison, Behind the Locked Door by Graham Thompson, will shortly, Graham, be available in a new edition?
It's out now. I'm holding it now. Yeah, it should be available in all the usual places.
Excellent.
Thoroughly recommended, folks. And thanks again, Graham, and I hope to speak to you again sometime.
Thank you very much, Graham.
Likewise. Yeah, bye. Thank you, guys.
Okay.
Cheers.
All the very best.